This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Philosophy for Beginners. Today we meet a thinker whose voice is impossible to ignore if you want to understand politics, morality, and the human condition after the catastrophes of the 20th century. Her name is Hannah Arendt, born in 1906 in Königsberg, the same Baltic city that formed Immanuel Kant, and dead in New York in 1975. Arendt was not content to repeat inherited answers. She wanted to look at things as they are, without consolation or Kant. She watched a continent fall to totalitarianism, fled through the trapdoors of history more than once, and then with extraordinary clarity, wrote books that still shape the way we talk about freedom, authority, evil, truth, and the fragile splendor of public life. Where the existentialists wrestled with the solitude of the self, Arendt insisted that what most needs our attention is the world we share, the space between us in which words and deeds make history. She wanted to know how modern societies came to produce regimes that annihilated people and facts alike, and how, after such darkness, we could still act freely, begin anew, and safeguard a common world. Arendt grew up in a secular Jewish family that prized learning and argument. Her father died when she was young, leaving behind a library that became her secret apprenticeship. As a student, she fell in love with philosophy, and for a time, with her teacher Martin Heidegger. That relationship, later a source of moral anguish, taught her a double lesson: the intoxication of thinking and the danger of thinkers who forget the world. She wrote her doctoral dissertation on love in St. Augustine, a choice that already reveals one of her lifelong preoccupations, beginnings. Augustine says that to love is to will the good of the other as other. Arendt would spend her career describing the conditions under which such willing can show up in the public realm as action, promise, forgiveness. In 1933, as the Nazi grip tightened, she was arrested for helping collect evidence of anti-Semitic propaganda. Released, she fled to Paris, worked for Jewish relief organizations, and was interned in the Gurs camp after the German invasion. She escaped, wandered to Marseille, obtained papers with the help of underground networks, crossed Spain to Lisbon, and boarded a ship to New York with her mother and her husband, Heinrich Blücher. The experience of flight, of losing not only home, but worldliness, never left her. It taught her that politics begins not in the soul, but in the fragile institutions where people appear to one another, speak, and act. New York gave Arendt language and room to breathe. She wrote for German exile journals, worked as an editor at Schocken Books, and began to reassemble the smashed furniture of political judgment. In 1951, she published The Origins of Totalitarianism, a work unlike any other produced in the wake of war. She warned that what had happened in Europe was not just a worse tyranny on a familiar scale. It was a new form of domination that aimed at making human beings superfluous. Totalitarian movements, she argued, were prepared by loneliness and rootlessness, by masses cut loose from traditional classes and parties, hungry for belonging, available for ideology. They thrive on ideological fictions that explain everything and propaganda that corrodes the very distinction between truth and falsehood. They experiment not only with censorship, but with reality itself, using terror and lies to turn the human world into a laboratory. The camps, in Arendt's stark phrase, were factories for the manufacture of corpses and institutions for the abolition of spontaneity, places where the capacity to begin, to act unpredictably, could be crushed. She traced the prehistory of these regimes in anti-Semitism, imperialism, and the breakdown of constitutional orders. But she never reduced totalitarianism to causes alone. Her question was more disturbing. How do ordinary people become available to a politics that destroys the very space where people can be persons? Arendt's answer did not end with diagnosis. In The Human Condition, 1958, she tried to recover a language for the kind of life that totalitarianism obliterates, the vita activa, the active life. She distinguished three fundamental human activities. Labor is the endless cyclical effort by which we sustain biological life, eating, cleaning, tending the body and the household. It is necessary, noble in its necessity, but it returns us to the same place each day. Work is the fabrication of a stable world of things, tables, buildings, artworks, institutions, that outlasts any one of us and furnishes a common stage. Action is different from both. It is the unpredictable, plural, speech-filled activity by which we appear to one another, disclose who we are, and set new processes in motion. For action, you need plurality, the presence of others who are equal in dignity and distinct in identity, and you need a public realm, a space where words can be heard and deeds remembered. Freedom, for Arendt, is nothing mystical. It is the experience of beginning something new among others, the miracle of natality transposed into politics. We are not only mortals moving toward death, as Heidegger taught, but also beings who are born into a world that can always begin again. Because action is unpredictable and irreversible, it needs two virtues to keep human affairs from breaking apart: forgiveness and promise. Forgiveness releases us from the chain of consequences that flow from a deed. Promise binds us to a course of action in the future. Together, they make politics human. They recognize that we cannot foresee everything. No plan survives the encounter with reality. And yet, we are not simply at the mercy of events. In a free republic, citizens promise, forgive, keep, remember. When those capacities are replaced by terror or by the cynical shrug that says nothing matters, politics rots from within. Arendt's next controversies arrived with her reporting on the 1961 trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem. She traveled as a correspondent for The New Yorker and produced a book that coined a phrase both famous and misunderstood: the banality of evil. Eichmann, she wrote, was not a demonic mastermind. He was a bureaucrat who spoke in clichés and inhabited a language without thought. His great crime was not monstrous hatred, so much as thoughtlessness, an inability or refusal to imagine the standpoint of another, to interrupt the conveyor belt of orders with the question, should this be done? Arendt never denied the radical evil of the deeds. She argued that their execution depends on a social machinery that allows people to perform horrors without thinking. The storm that followed, accusations that she lacked empathy for victims, that she minimized guilt, bared raw wounds in European Jewry and in Arendt's own network of friends. She stood by her analysis and paid a price for its cold courage. What she would not abandon was the insistence that evil can take the form of unquestioning normality, that moral collapse begins when people outsource judgment to systems and slogans. Arendt was not a cynic about judgment. In the posthumously published lectures on Kant's political philosophy, she proposed that political judgment is a kind of enlarged thinking. the effort to take into account the perspectives of others without ceasing to be oneself. Kant had spoken of public use of reason. Arendt, the student of revolutions and assemblies, made that publicness tangible. To judge well is to imagine how a deed or a law will appear to many. It is to appeal to a sensus communis, a shared sense of the world. Judgment cannot be captured by algorithms or deduced from axioms. It is a worldly virtue trained in conversation, in reading, in the give and take of civic life. Where totalitarianism destroys that world, judgment dies. Where the public sphere is flooded with lies and noise, judgment withers into tribe. If Origins diagnosed a sickness and the human condition celebrated the conditions of health, On Revolution, 1963, asked where modern politics had gone astray. Arendt compared the American and French revolutions. The French, she argued, were captured by the social question, the urgent problem of poverty, which dragged the revolution from the realm of freedom into cycles of necessity and terror. The Americans, by contrast, succeeded in founding lasting institutions, councils, town meetings, constitutional mechanisms that made spaces for citizens to act in concert. Arendt admired the American experiment, not as mythology, but for its institutional imagination, its ability to build durable forms where freedom can appear. She distrusted the modern confusion of politics with administration and of liberty with consumption. Politics is not the efficient delivery of goods. It is the practice of citizens who speak and act together in public. When we treat politics as management, we evacuate the very thing that makes it worth having. This defense of the public realm led Arendt to unpopular positions. In her essay, Truth and Politics, she observed that political lies are not new. What is new is the scale on which modern states can fabricate reality itself. Factual truth, she wrote, is fragile because it depends on witnesses, documents, records, and the willingness of citizens to care about what happened. Opinion is the lifeblood of democracy, but facts are its ground. When states lie about the past, or when citizens become bored with truth, freedom is in peril. She wrote also Lying in Politics, a postmortem on the Pentagon Papers, arguing that self-deception among elites is even more dangerous than deceiving the public. A government that cannot tell itself the truth cannot govern free people. And in Civil Disobedience, she insisted that organized, principled refusal has a place in constitutional life, not as rebellion against law, but as an appeal to the founding promises of the Republic. Arendt's writing always returned to beginnings. She admired the spontaneous council systems that appeared in revolutions, from the American committees of correspondence to the workers' councils in Hungary and Germany, as moments when ordinary people invented forms for acting together. She knew they were fragile, frequently crushed by parties and bureaucracies, but she took them as proofs that freedom is not a theory. It is a practice that appears whenever people find ways to speak and act in concert. That conviction gave her work its paradoxical hopefulness. Even after terror, even after lies, there remains the human capacity to begin again. Her life, too, was a practice in beginning. In New York, she became an American citizen and taught at the New School and the University of Chicago, lecturing in prose that was both sharp and lush, with an accent that made her sentences sound like declarations from a tribunal. She reconciled imperfectly and painfully with some of her German past, including letters exchanged with Heidegger. She maintained friendships with figures like Karl Jaspers, who insisted that thought must be accountable to the world. She smoked incessantly, loved conversation, adored the city's bustle, and never let go of the memory of statelessness. To be without a polity, she had learned, is to be without the rights that protect the person. Rights do not spring from humanity. They spring from membership in a political community that can guarantee them. That hard lesson still reverberates whenever refugees are herded at borders or bureaucracies deny that a person is a person. Arendt has never ceased to be controversial. Admirers celebrate her as the clearest analyst of totalitarianism, the defender of a politics of appearance and speech, the woman who restored natality to philosophy. Critics charge that she romanticized the American founding, misunderstood social suffering, or drew too neat a line between labor, work, and action. Some say she failed to see how race and gender shape the public realm she prized. Others insist that the banality of evil flattens the psychology of perpetrators. Serious readers have to wrestle with these objections because her work invites wrestling. It refuses closure. Arendt's virtue was not correctness, it was fearlessness in thinking in public, with the stakes of the world in mind. If we ask why Arendt matters now, the answers crowd forward. She warned that loneliness, the corrosion of common sense and common world, makes people vulnerable to conspiracy and tyranny. She warned that contempt for factual truth hollows out judgment until public life becomes theater. She warned that the substitution of management for politics turns citizens into clients, rights into services, institutions into machines. She insisted that freedom requires spaces of appearance where people can speak and be seen, not only screen-mediated echo chambers, but actual forums where disagreement can ripen into decision. She insisted that the remedy for the unpredictability of action is not control, but promising and forgiving, civic virtues we can practice. She insisted, above all, that human beings are capable of beginnings. We are not doomed to repeat our errors. We can found, refound, and repair a world worthy of sharing. Think of current crises, disinformation storms, autocratic temptations, the displacement of millions by war and climate, the temptation to replace politics with algorithms. Arendt would not give us a plan. She would say, look closely at what is happening. Protect the institutions that hold factual truth. Defend the public realm against both violence and apathy. Cultivate judgment by exposing yourself to many perspectives. Resist the loneliness that leaves people prey to ideology. Create forms where freedom can appear. She would remind us that politics is not a headache to be outsourced, but a practice of plurality. She would remind us that the answer to cynicism is not optimism, but courage, the ordinary. Courage to speak and act with others, to keep promises, to forgive, to begin. Arendt died of a heart attack in her apartment on Riverside Drive in December 1975, a page of a lecture on Kant's Critique of Judgment left on her typewriter. It is fitting that judgment had the last word. She had spent her life modeling what it looks like to think without banisters, as she put it, to move through the world without the handrails of metaphysics, guided by attention, memory, and the love of a common world. She had lived through the worst that politics can become and still insisted that politics is the only human way of being together without a master. She had watched truth be trampled and still insisted that truth can be spoken. She had seen beginnings snuffed out and still insisted that beginnings are always possible. Thank you for listening to this episode of Philosophy for Beginners. In our next stage, we will continue our journey through the later 20th century, turning to Michel Foucault, who traced the subtle workings of power through prisons, clinics, and schools, and asked how truth itself is shaped by regimes of knowledge, and then to other modern voices who reimagined freedom, responsibility, and the public realm. But before we leave Hannah Arendt, remember this. She reminds us that freedom is not an inner feeling, but a worldly achievement. That truth is not a possession, but a practice, and that the miracle of politics is that, among others, we can begin again. Produced by Selenius Media. Music by The Artificial Laboratory. Mm-hmm.